Beginning basic object of interest, and I think it must have been completely manifest from his lectures that this is a beast that cares very, very little about any particular local space-time picture for what's going on. Very, very closely associated with that is the fact that the natural objects that we can associate with this contour integral of the Grassmannian manage to simultaneously manifest these two symmetries, the conformal, superconformal invariance and the dual superconformal invariance, which any local description would simply make impossible. Okay? So that's the I should stress, this is really, there are two very powerful hints that some second good way of thinking about Yang-Mills scattering amplitude should exist. The first one was the incredible simplicity of the BCFW recursion relations that we're just going to talk about in a second, the fact that the answers were very simple. But really closely associated with that, and less aesthetically, the fact that they manifest a different symmetry is the final nail in the coffin of the standard Lagrangian way of thinking about things. That you could decide whether or not it was simple or not simple. It was a little bit of a matter of taste, perhaps. Although when it goes from hundreds of thousands of terms to three terms, that's fairly striking. But the fact that they manifest a different symmetry and that symmetry knows about a completely t-dual space on which physics cannot be standardly local in the usual language is what crystallizes the thought that there must be some way of talking about these things that doesn't put in the local space-time physics by hand and gets it out. So the object that Freddie introduced, this contour integral, is such a thing. Okay, it doesn't live in space-time. It's this interesting abstract object. It's a machine for generating invariants. Mathematically, it's a machine for generating invariants of this wonderful infinite dimensional Yangian symmetry. And physically, the conjecture was, and it was a conjecture, now it's essentially proven, the proof will come tomorrow, that contour integral, the residues of this contour integral compute, are closely related to scattering amplitudes, in fact, compute all leading singularities of scattering amplitudes. And that if you want to know, there's even a very simple map between any given leading singularity picture, any complicated picture you want to draw for a leading singularity on one side, and a particular residue of this Grassmannian integral on the other side. So such a correspondence exists. We'll talk about it perhaps in a little bit more detail tomorrow. But now what we'd like to do is start seeing more. How does space-time physics come out of this object? How does local space-time physics come out of it? And to do that, we should start not just talking in abstractly about all the leading singularity contains and so on, but start talking about tree amplitudes and see in particular how tree amplitudes are contained in this object, which residues of this Grassmannian correspond to the objects that are in the tree amplitude. Okay? So we're going to start doing that today. We're going to start doing that today by finishing the discussion, the general discussion by talking about the BCFW recursion relations and giving you an example of the simplest non-trivial application for the six-particle amplitude at tree level, and then we'll talk about how it's realized in the Grassmannian. We'll start talking about how what sort of contour you have to choose to get the tree amplitudes out, and focus the discussion for six-particle amplitudes, for general NMH tree amplitudes, and then make a number of comments about it. So today is the beginning of seeing how you extract, how you piece the objects that are spat out by this Grassmannian integral together to make physical quantities. Okay? Today, the logic is that we're going to figure out we're going to figure out what the tree amplitude is, and the derivation for what the tree amplitude is ultimately going to be from field theory. Okay, so we're going to derive the BCFW recursion relations from field theory. it's a psychologically interesting game that we're playing. Okay, on the one hand, we're going to start from field theory, derive these recursion relations that are going to allow us to compute the tree amplitudes in a shockingly simple way. Okay, now you might say this is a wonderful ode to the power of field theory. Because we start from field theory, the standard Lagrangian formalism of field theory, we think about it in some clever way, we think about singularities, we'll do the exercise we do, and we'll get a nice derivation of what the tree amplitudes are. But BCFW really sat for a number of years at a very interesting crossroads between field theory and some dual way of thinking about things. As I said, on the one hand, you could derive them from field theory, but on the other hand, the structure of the answer was so unlike things you're used to seeing in field theory, and it exhibited the symmetry that field theory completely obscured. So that way of writing it seems to be connected to some other way of doing the computation, some totally different way of doing the computation from totally different rules, totally different initial starting point. Okay? So it sits in the middle. The BCFW recursion relations are a meeting ground between a standard formulation of quantum field theory and a dual formulation. Okay? They will both end up computing the tree amplitudes in a natural way to yield the same formulas, but the logic that leads to the conclusion.
idea that there's one way of looking at things where it's local, another way which has got all these symmetries, but they're ultimately two halves of the same coin? Or are you thinking that there's a bigger picture where it may be that some theories are not describable by local?
This theory, of course, is described by local formulation. We know, I mean, backing up for a second, part of the very big motivation here, the very, very big motivation, is that we eventually have to lose locality. We know that. We have, because of gravity, there aren't any local observables. So because of that, it makes sense to look for ways of formulating. In some approximation, what looks like local physics. That's why these are wonderful questions to ask, because it's ultra sharp. You're trying to take something where you know for a fact that it's dead local, and you're trying to reformulate it in a way that doesn't have locality built in. That's a very powerful check that you're doing something right, because you have to be able to reproduce the answers you know exactly, and you have to be able to see where they come from. This is like it's a highfalutin motivation for doing this. But I think it is a good one. Such a formulation really should exist, because whatever the correspondence limit is of the theory with gravity, and the limit is you decouple gravity, it can't all of a sudden reintroduce in all of the space-time that just isn't there at all, fundamentally, with gravity turned on. It has to match to a theory which is not the standard formulation of quantum field theory, but some other formulation where the space-time isn't in manifestly. That's what we're searching for. So that's part of the big motivation. Of course, these theories are dead local. There are lots of other theories very closely related to this one, like the 2,0 theory in six dimensions. That's, if you like, one step more hard removed from here, because that's a theory that we think is local, exactly local, but doesn't even have a Lagrangian. We don't even have the luxury of starting to talk about it and even have something to compare it to. But that's another class of theory, of course, is very closely related to this one. It's this one under compactification. Okay? So there's lots and lots of motivations for trying to get rid of the Lagrangian. We know that it's been obscuring lots and lots of things that have been going on. So that's part of the overarching motivation. Having said that, what we're seeing here is not, I mean, what you might really like, which we don't have, what you might really like is some description of the physics with a gigantic, gigantic amount of gauge symmetry, where when you fix the gauge symmetry in different ways, in one formulation it looks local, another formulation it makes the Yang invariant, you know, so that you can actually really connect them. We don't have that. Okay. What we're finding is a formulation where the symmetries are all manifest, but moving in that direction, we're seeing that there are natural questions you can ask of this object on its own turf, okay, whose answers yield first tree amplitudes and then loop amplitudes. Okay. So that suggests that there is some deeper principles from which. Where the invariant symmetries are being kept more manifest, but where the space-time and the unitarity are emerging as more secondary concepts. So that's what we're after. Okay. And you'll see in a second, the question specifically, both questions, but in this lecture we'll see it, the question of what space-time locality means, immediately goes from being some very, very sounding question to an ultra-concrete question about some identity that must be true. Okay, so it's just great, because you turn this big vague question into something that you can really sharply work on, and we'll just see it in action. Okay. Yes.
More pragmatically, so do you have a contour that gives you the end loop contribution with n particle amplitude?
Yes. Yes. So that's what my part of the lecture is will be about. Okay. So let's talk about but we're going back to the VCFW recursion equation. So the idea here is we know that the tree amplitude is a rational function of the external momenta. And the idea is to try to determine what it is in terms of its singularities. We know the only kind of singularities it has at tree level are poles. And furthermore, we know what kinds of singularities can it have? So Here, in this entire argument, we're really using a lot the fact that there's an underlying local field theory. We don't need any detailed properties of the Feynman diagrams, but we need to think that it's coming from a Feynman diagram somehow. So what are all the possible poles that this object can have? Well, the poles occur when the sum of the subset of the momenta outside become null. Okay? And that corresponds to a situation. So there's some subset of momentum on the left and on the right. I break it up into two sets. And if the sum of all the momenta on the left, let's call it P left squared, as P left squared goes to zero, then we know that this object, that the tree amplitude develops a pole. Now, furthermore, the residue of that pole is a nice, well-defined object. The residue is determined in terms of the lower point amplitudes. Okay? In fact, we know that as P left squared goes to zero, the amplitude factorizes into some m left, which is an on-shell tree amplitude for all the particles on the left, plus an intermediate particle I, 1 over p left squared, m right, is a function of all the right particles, and this particle having momentum negative I. And if I have many species, I need the sum over everything, sum over all intermediate particles. There's many helicities, many different kinds of particles that need to sum over all. Okay. So this is just a very basic consequence of tree-level Feynman diagrams. So if you just think about tree-level Feynman diagrams, this sort of similarity structure is guaranteed. So we know that as a function of many complex momenta, this thing has poles. We know the residue of the poles are computed by lower point amplitudes. So this should give us a way of recursively building up higher point amplitudes starting from lower point. Now, this is a strategy that sounds familiar from the 1960s with one crucial difference. In the 1960s, people immediately started complexifying the kinematic invariants like S and T. And this is an okay idea for four particles if it's a disaster above four particles. So here instead, we're going to, following BC and F, W, we're going to complexify the momenta directly. Okay? And as you see, in everything that we're doing throughout the entire rest of the business, everything has been complex from the start. The lambdas, the lambdas, everything has been complex from the start. Okay, so all the momenta are complex. And we want to determine the amplitude from its poles. So the idea is to simplify life by not making everything complex from the get-go, but make as few things as complex as you can. So if it was me trying it, I would try to make one thing complex. Okay? I would say take P1 and somehow deform P1 to be a function of some complex variable z. So I'm going to deform P1 to some P1 of z and make it complex. Unfortunately, I can't just make one momentum complex because of momentum conservation. So I need to make at least two momenta complex. If it was me, I would have probably given up at one momentum being complex, but you can have the brilliant insight to continue to make two momenta complex. So we can make two momenta complex. So how would we do it? We would take P1, oh, this mirror is in here. I was going to really annoy him by doing this. So we're going to take P1 of z to be P1 plus z times some q. Z is complex. And P2 of u is P2 minus zq. Nothing here is even restricted to four dimensions at the moment. Okay? Now momentum is conserved. I've deformed two momenta. But I need to make sure that this is on shell. So I want to make sure that P1 squared and P2 squared of z continue to be zero. So that tells me that I have to have q squared equals zero. I have to have q dot p1 equals 0 and q dot p2 equals 0. Okay, for all values of z, where that should be the case. Right? Now, with real momenta, these conditions are impossible to satisfy. If q is a real momentum, these conditions are impossible to satisfy. But if q is complex, they are possible to satisfy. And just so I write it down once, and then we'll switch to lambdas and lambda tildes immediately. But just so you see, it's actually true in any number of dimensions. Let's say we go to a frame where we make P1, 1, 1, and then a string of zeros, however many dimensions there are, and P2, I go to a frame where they're back to back. So it's 1 minus 1, 0, 0, dot, dot. And I'm choosing units where the energy is 1. For for P1 and P2, then you can very simply choose Q to be, for example, 0, 0, 1i, and then all the rest of them are 0. Any number of dimensions. So that satisfies both of these constraints. Q squared is 0, Q dot P1 and P2 are 0. This PCF deformation can be done in any number of dimensions. It's just a very canonical, the most canonical way of making the amplitude complex. Okay, great. But we are living in four dimensions, and we know to use spin helicity variables to talk about the amplitudes. So let's say what this deformation is in terms of let's say what this deformation is as a deformation of lambdas and lambda tildes, and a deformation that says lambda 1 of z is lambda 1 plus z lambda 2, and lambda 2 tilde of z is lambda 2 tilde minus z lambda 1 tilde. You see, this guarantees that momentum is conserved because lambda 1 tilde plus lambda 2 tilde of z, the cross terms cancel between them. So this is equals lambda 1 tilde plus lambda 2 lambda 2 tilde. And what this is affecting is precisely P1 goes to P1 plus ZQ, P2 goes to P2 minus ZQ, where Q is lambda 1, lambda 2 tilde. Q is that vector, lambda 1, lambda 2 tilde. Okay, great. So this takes our amplitude M, and it makes it a function of Z. Our amplitude was a function of the lambdas and the lambda tildes. At the moment, there's no Suzy. This is being phrased non-supersymmetrically. Now it's a function of lambda, lambda, tilde, and z. And we're going to think about it as a function of z. Okay. Now, in the z-plane, in the z-complex plane, this function is going to have a bunch of poles. Where will it have poles? Well, it's, so what we're doing now is allowing, by moving P1 and P2, we're allowing ourselves to access many of these general factorization channels that we're talking about. Okay? So these poles will happen when some sum of the external momenta become null. If the theory is planar, which is what we're talking about here, again, this basic idea has nothing to do with planarity, but just restricting it to a planarity, all the diagrams we draw will have the external particles in some order, in the same cyclic ordering. And so this is going to happen when, again, some sum of the subset of these cyclically ordered guys become null. Now, it's easy to see that we will never get a certain sort of pole. Let's say 1 and 2 are both contained in L or in R. If 1 and 2 are both contained in L and in R, you'll notice that the overall sum of the momenta going in is proportional to P1 plus P2 plus everything else, and P1 plus P2 is not deformed. Okay? Precisely, that was the point. P1 plus P2 is invariant. On the other hand, there will be some, there will be every channel where I have P1 on one side, 1 on one side, with a bunch of its, with a bunch of other guys that are not 2, 2 on the other side, okay? And then there will be some value of Z for which that sum of momenta goes on shell. So the poles here are going to correspond to, there's going to be as many of them as there are ways of decomposing the external particles into two sets, with one containing particle 1 and the other one containing particle 2. So we'll have particle 1 on one side and a bunch of other things. And since it's planar, and we decided to deform just the guy next to it, then 2 is going to have to be right here. 2, 3, etc. Okay? So here's L and R. So for every way of decomposing the particles into two sets, we'll have a pole. Okay? And the residue on that pole, well, we know the residue on that pole, because we know what it looks like in that neighborhood. The residue on that pole is given in terms of lower particle amplitudes, summed over all the particles that can run in the intermediate channel. Okay. So this is great. So we have an analytic function. Well, we have a meromorphic function. We know its poles. We know its residues. We can compute it completely. We can compute it purely in terms of its poles. There's only one catch, one possible catch. There's one pole we didn't talk about, which is a possible pole at infinity. Let me remind you what the basic structure of the argument is. So if you have a function of z and you know all of its poles, and you want to know what it is when z is equal to 0, which is what we're interested in. What did I do?
What's the thing I don't
know? Oh, both of them are up here. So if you have a if you have a function of z and you know its poles, then f of 0 is just the contour integral around z equals 0, d0 over z, m of z, so z equals 0. But then we can deform the contour away from z equals 0 and write it as a sum. This is as a sum of 1 over z star at all the residues times the residue of m at z star. Plus the pole at infinity, plus a contribution from the pole at infinity, okay? Plus the residue at infinity, plus the pole at infinity. So it would be awesome if, for some reason, this amplitude vanished at infinity. If it vanished at infinity, then we're just done. Actually, it's not strictly necessary that it vanish. It could just, if it went exactly like z at infinity, that would be fine too. It just shouldn't have a piece that goes like a constant at infinity, that which would give it a pole at infinity. But it would be particularly nice if it vanished at infinity. Okay. Now, in fact, this property it seems so obvious that you might just do it and just assume that it's true. But actually, when you look at very simple theories, 5 of the 4th theory, I mean, nowhere here did I say anything about gauge theory. It's a very, very general strategy. It's actually naively never true. It's never true that the amplitude vanishes at infinity. If you think about 5 of the 4th theory, just the simplest example, just a 4-particle amplitude, it's a constant. So it's a constant at infinity. There's a pole at infinity. There's always a pole at infinity in any scalar theory. And very naively, if you look at what these amplitudes look like in gauge theory, now we have to talk about what the polarizations of particles 1 and 2 are. Okay? Now it depends on exactly what helicity particles I'm talking about. But actually, no matter what you do, if you just think about Feynman diagrams and dotting the polarization vectors, very naively, individually, not very naively, simply true, individual Feynman diagrams blow up as z goes to infinity. That's a true statement in gauge theory. It's an even more true statement in gravity, where they blow up even worse, way, way worse, as you go to infinity. And so this looks like a great strategy, but it doesn't seem to be true. However, of course, it turns out that while individual Feynman diagrams blow up at infinity, the sum does not. The full amplitude actually does vanish at infinity. And there are some simple arguments, simple physical arguments for why this is true, related to the fact that the behavior as z goes to infinity here is very sort of intuitively transparent. You have a particle that's moving faster and faster. The q dominates over everything. And in the z goes to infinity limit, you have a hard particle blasting through a soft background. And then some simple background field method arguments, together with some simple symmetry analysis, shows you that for certain helicities of particles, the amplitude does indeed vanish as you go to infinity. So for instance, if you're doing this in gauge theory of gravity, if particle 1, if the helicities of 1 and 2 are anything other than minus plus, then the amplitude vanishes at infinity. If it's minus plus, it does blow up, actually. Okay. For both gauge theory and for gravity. But when it dies, not only does it dies like 1 over z for gauge theory and 1 over z squared for gravity. So not only is it not worse for gravity, it's actually better. So this is quite remarkable. Okay, so which means that this program actually works. So you can go ahead and compute the amplitude just knowing its poles. Okay? All right? And in fact, it's a very simple formula. We can just write it down. We have that the PL of z is whatever it was before plus z times, from our deformation, we said lambda 1, lambda 2, lambda 1 tilde. So we want to set PL squared of z. PL squared of z is whatever PL squared plus 2 PL sandwiched between 2 and 1 tilde. Let me just write 1 of that z. So this is equal to 0 at the value of z star is equal to, well, just minus PL squared over 2, 1, PL2. And if I just compute the residue, what I find is that m of z, m of 0, which is what I want, is the sum over all the helicities running around the loop of m left at z star, 1 over PL squared, just the original 1 over PL squared, undeformed m right, evaluated at z star. And this is the sum over all the helicities of the particles and over all the ways of splitting things into L and R. Okay. So I hope this is clear. There, for every way that I can split these guys into two sets, there's a particular value of z, which is associated with putting the internal guy on shell. And you simply evaluate the left tree amplitude, the right tree amplitude at that configuration. You multiply them, sum over everyone that can run in that channel, and divide by the original PL score. Okay? This is the formula. Okay. Now, everything I said so far was non-supersymmetric, and there's something a little annoying sounding about the fact that the that things depend on the helicity. The plus minus amplitude, the minus plus amplitude is different than all the other ones in a gauge theory. Sounds a little bit funny. It sounds a little funny, especially if we're thinking about n equals 4 super Yang mills, where all the helicities are unified with each other in one multiplier. There seems to be something odd about the fact that the helicities are being treated so differently here. There must be some way of doing the recursion that that allows you to not to have to make any reference to helicity, to just talk about it supersymmetrically. And there is, of course. It's obscured in this way of talking about it in terms of the helicities directly, because the helicities are not the natural basis to talk about the amplitudes. The natural basis to talk about the superamplitudes is this on-shell superspace that we talked about, where you label the external particles by Grassmann parameters. So really, we should be talking about m of lambda, lambda tilde, and eta tilde. Okay. And remember, we did this deformation. We deformed two particles in order to make sure that the momentum was conserved. But in a supersymmetric theory, it's artificial to make sure the momentum is conserved without also making sure that the supermomentum is conserved. So in order to do this, we have to also deform the eta tildes in such a way to ensure that the supermomentum is conserved. Because it was a supermomentum, it was just a Grassmann delta function. Grassmann delta functions don't force things to vanish when you're not on the support of them. They're just polynomials. So if you didn't deform it to make sure you kept the supermomentum conserved, you weren't punished immediately by seeing that the object didn't make sense. Okay? But you were punished ultimately by not seeing the symmetry between all of the different helicities. So if you also deform the Grassmann parameter, everything's okay. This is a completely trivial, totally trivial and obvious generalization of the way of implementing BCFW for supersymmetric theories. So now we have lambda 1 is equal of z is lambda 1 plus z lambda 2. Lambda 2 tilde of z
is lambda 2 tilde minus z lambda 1 tilde. And finally, eta 2 tilde also gets the form. It's eta tilde 2 minus z eta tilde 1. And you can see that this guarantees that lambda 1 eta 1 tilde plus lambda 2 eta 2 tilde plus dot 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 the super, the object that occurs in the super momentum conservation equation. This thing is undeformed. So this is just the supersymmetric version of BCFW. And now the statement is that this super amplitude under that super deformation vanishes to infinity, like 1 over z. Now, no statement about helicity is nothing. Okay? Just the super amplitude vanishes as it doesn't go to infinity. In fact, at n equals 8, it vanishes like 1 over z squared, but we're not talking about n equals 8. Okay. So that means that we can use BCFW to compute any amplitude that we like, n equals 4 super angles at tree level. In fact, if you like, you could do something that you could even do something that would be a little bit perverse. I mention it just because we're going to make use of this thing in a second. Remember I told you that you can't deform lambda 1 and lambda 2 tilde, right? If the helicities were minus and plus. Well, nothing stops you from using these recursion relations. I mean, you can use these recursion relations for anything you like, for any helicity combination you like. It involves deforming these eta tildes, of course. Okay? But you can actually do it. But you could then choose to look at this deformation when the external helicities were minus and plus. Okay? So the thing that you actually can't do is pure gauge theory. Okay? Well, how does it work out in the supersymmetric case? The way it works out is that it's you can't simply use the poles of the pure gauge theory, but actually using the whole multiplet in the n equals 4, you get a nice answer. That's and in fact, it's just a trivial consequence of the Fourier transformation between the two representations that that Freddie probably told you about in the very, very first lecture. Okay? So the first way, so there's a most natural way that you might call BCFW, but this other way, where you do it the wrong way around, you might want to call the parity conjugate of BCFW. It gives you another set of answers. It's not the same. Okay? And in fact, if you wanted to compute it in components, it's very different. It would involve the whole multiplet. But if you do it supersymmetrically, it's basically the same computation. Okay? You're just taking different projections, integrating things out in different ways. So there's BCFW, which was there even for pure gauge theory, and there's the parity conjugate version of it, which is natural in n equals 4. Okay? So we can talk about both of them. All right. Now, so that's the general strategy, and let me now give you the first non-trivial example. Well, you can use BCFW to trivially compute all the n equals 2 so-called NHV amplitudes, including the Park-Taylor formula. So that's a very nice application, it's a very fast calculation. But let's move on to the next most interesting example. The first, which has the real juice in it. So this is the sixth particle next to MHV amplitude. So m equals 3 with 6 particles. So 3 negative helicity gluons. I could write it all supersymmetrically, but let me just focus on a particular helicity combination. Okay. So I maybe should have written this down beforehand. But let's look at the amplitude. Six, one, 2, that, oh, oops, this helicity combination, so 3 negative, 3 positive helicity, and they're alternating. So this is the kind of furthest away from an MHV amplitude that you might get, 6 particles, okay? All right, and let me just write down, so first a quick comment. You've probably heard this sort of thing many times, but if you were to compute this amplitude with Feynman diagrams, there would be 220 Feynman diagrams. I don't know how many, 100,000 terms, I don't know how many terms, tons and tons and tons of terms. Amazingly complicated. And this is the answer as you compute from BCFW. The answer is the sum of 3 terms, so I'll tell you what this means in a second. Oops. That's what you get from BCFL. This G up, this G is just an operation that rotates the indices by one. So G squared means take this expression, and so G takes the index I and shifts it by one. So this means take this expression and add its two cyclic images where you clock it over by two, and that's obvious because this object is a natural cycling over by two symmetry, okay? Because of its alternating configuration. All right, so that's the whole result. Now let's stare at this for a second.
And you may want to define the notation.
Oh, I'm sorry. Right, this here means 5, 6 plus 1, 2, for example, means 5, well, P5 plus P6, P6 plus P1, 2. Okay? So it would be 5, so that first term would be 5, 6, 6, 2, plus 5, 1, 1, 2. All right. So this is a fascinating formula because you see all the things we've been talking about abstractly. So this guy has certain poles in it, okay? But there are poles where this vanishes, that vanishes. There are poles where all these things vanish, obviously, okay? Every one of these poles is a sensible one. By sensible, I mean it has a nice local interpretation in terms of space-time propagation. Okay? Every one of those poles is of the form, for example, let's look at that guy. So to make it look more familiar, let me multiply and divide by 2, 3. Okay? So that's nothing other than P2 plus P3 squared. Okay? P2 dot P3. So that pole corresponds to some factorization picture where P2 plus P3 are going on shells and particles propagating a long distance and then something happens there. Okay? That's a local pole in space-time. Every one of these things is a local pole in space-time. That's a local pole in space-time. It's a multi-particle one where 5 plus 6 plus 1 are coming together and then there's something going on shell going a long way and something is happening outside. Okay? These are all legal local poles. Okay? So these are local. But I've separated out these funny guys. These are spurious. Well, let's not call them spurious yet. They're non-local. They don't have that interpretation. And if you were to take them and do the same thing, multiply by their conjugate, divide by their conjugate, they're poles that would look roughly like a p squared, q squared, minus r squared, S squared, okay? So they look like a quartic in the denominator and the difference of two product of sums of momenta like that, in general. This has no local interpretation in space-time at all. Okay? All right, so we have the sum of three terms. Somehow, the zillions of Feynman diagrams have collapsed into the sum of three terms, but this simplicity is happening at an interesting cost. It's happening at the cost of having each individual term not have a local interpretation in space-time. I can't ascribe this term to some particular local process in space-time.
So yes, times or plus?
Times. I just split off the local and non-local poles just to make sure. Okay. So, obviously what must happen is that if you sum these three terms, those non-local poles cancel magically. And all you're left with is the local poles. All right? One derivation of that fact is that we just derived this whole thing from quantum field theory. We know it's coming from Feynman diagrams. There's no non-local poles anywhere, so it must be true. Okay? But it's a pretty circuitous derivation, right? We've got to go back to this picture. I have to finish telling you the story about why things vanish at infinity. There's a long song and dance in order to come to a very sharp statement. The sum of these three terms should cancel all the spurious faults. So this is what I was mentioning to you before, Cliff. Now the question of how do you see where is locality coming from and so on has turned into something very sharp. Each one of these terms, now from hindsight, we also know each one of these terms is Yang invariant. Okay? Each one of these terms is telling us about all the symmetries of the theory. But beyond that sort of kinematic fact about the symmetries, something has to tell us to put them together in a special way to cancel the non-local pulse. How do you even see that they're canceled? Can you take this and actually just check the spurious pulse cancel? Well, you can try. Even in this very, very simplest example, it is hell to prove analytically that the spurious pulse cancel there. In fact, I have not done it. Okay? Maybe I have, actually. Maybe we did. Not literally this exercise. All right, now, there is something that's actually a little bit helpful. It turns out, in this particular six-particle example, remember I told you, you can BCF picking any guys you want. Any one, instead of one and two, I could have picked two and three, three and four, and so on. Okay. Actually, we'll do one of the terms in a second, but it's actually far from obvious ahead of time that it'll even have the structure of one term just cycled over, because the bits and pieces don't even look like that. So that's already surprising. But it turns out in this case, that's a special case about the six particles, that no matter which guys you BCF'd, whether you did one and two, two and three, three and four, no matter what you did, you'd always end up with the same formula. So this is not a case where there, within BCF itself, you have different representations. In this case, you just get the same answer. But remember I told you in n equals four, there's that parity conjugate version. So let me tell you what the parity conjugate version of this formula is, if you did it in n equals four.
But you could use non-neighboring particles.
You can also use non-neighboring particles, and then you have more terms.
With poles at different positions.
With poles in different positions. So that's something that you could do as well. You could try to compare. But I'm trying to keep everything planar now. Well, basically, we're heading in the same direction. Okay? So if we use the PBCF, then the formula ends up being same structure, 1 plus p squared plus g to the 4th. And now there's a funny numerator. Now, it's not very important to pay attention to the details except for one thing. The local poles are the same in these two formulas when you cycle over all of the images. However, you can see that the non-local poles do not agree. The non-local poles involve odd guys in angle brackets there and even guys in angle brackets there. Okay? And the non-local poles are different. Now, it's a remarkable identity that the amplitude as computed by BCFW is equal to the amplitude as computed by PBCFW. This must be a true statement. Again, this is a true statement that follows from field theory. Okay? But this is now giving us an interesting six-term identity. Right? There's a six-term identity that says that these three terms are equal to those three terms, the sum of those three. Now we have something easier to try to check. Rather than trying to check that the spurious poles cancel, we can try to check something else. We can try to directly verify this identity. If we could verify this identity, we would, incidentally, also prove that spurious poles cancel, the non-local poles cancel. Why? Because the non-local poles are different on the left and on the right. Okay? So from the left form, it's clear that the right non-local poles don't exist and vice versa. So there's a remarkable six-term identity here. And if there is going to be a hope of having a second picture for where these amplitudes are coming from, whatever that picture is, had better give us a good explanation for this identity. Okay? Because that's the explanation for how local physics manages to come out of this form. All right. Well, as I think Freddy's already alluded to, what's going to happen is that we're going to identify each of these terms as residues of the Grassmannian integral, and the six-term identity in the simplest case is just a simple example of Cauchy's theorem, not even the fancy global residue theorem. This is the simplest case where there's for n equals 3, the Grassmannian integral turns into a one-dimensional contour integral, and the six-term identity is just a residue theorem. Again, this six-term identity is something, if you try to directly prove by hand algebraically, it's just a nightmare. You have zero insight into why it's happening. Okay. But it's completely obvious from the this big picture of the contour.
Sorry, just explain again why the equivalence between these two is essential to locality.
Yes, because this identity proves that the non-local poles are absent. The reason is that on this side, we have one sort of non-local pole, mm-hmm. and on this side, we have different non-local poles. Okay, so if they're equal to each other, the residues on those poles must vanish. There must not be any divergences there. Okay, so the writing it as an equality of two things equaling to each other is easier than just checking that the non-local poles cancel in one of them. Okay, so this is and the equivalence between these two forms is telling us that that the physics can look local. Okay. So that's what we'd like to that's what we'd like to understand better.
It's not obvious they have the same poles.
Sorry?
It's not obvious they have the same poles.
They have the same local poles.
It's not obvious from what you wrote down, I don't know.
They do because you see, for example, so you have P6 plus P1 plus P2, then you have another one which is 2 over is P2 plus P3 plus P4, okay. And then also P4 plus P5 plus P6. Okay? So we have all of them, and you'll notice that P5 plus P6 plus P1 is equal to P2 plus P3 plus P4. Okay? Yeah. So that fact is what makes it matter. Yes, thank you, I should have said that. Okay, great. Now, I stress this is the simplest case. If you talk about the 7 particle next to MHV amplitude with m equals 3, there is a 12-term identity. For 8 particle, there's a 20-term identity. If it's n squared MHV, m equals 4, there's a 40-term identity. I mean, it quickly becomes just ridiculous. Okay? So verifying by hand is clearly wrong. There must be a better way of thinking about it. All right, great. So what I want to do just for our edification is actually do one of these little computations just so you see actually how it works. All right. So I want to compute this 6 particle amplitude. I'm going to compute one of the terms in the recursion relation. So of the I'm doing it having deformed lambda 6, so I'm going to do deform 6 and 1. Okay. 6 as helicity plus, 1 as helicity minus. So I have lambda 6 of z is lambda 6 plus z lambda 1. Lambda tilde 1 of z is lambda tilde 1 minus z lambda tilde 6. Okay? And so there's three diagrams, in principle, I should draw. So one typically puts a hat on the guys that are deformed. Here's one of them. So this is plus, minus. Then we have 1 minus 2 plus 3 minus 4 plus. This is one way of splitting them into two pieces. Another way would have the 4 on this side.
4 plus 5 minus 6 plus 1, 2, 3. And the final one would have also 3 on this side. So in this case, there's 3 different terms. There's 3 BCFW terms. Those are the 3 terms that we're talking about. Okay. I'll just compute this one for you.
It's not obvious that they are the cyclic.
Definitely not. Definitely not. Definitely not. That's so. There's a whole variety of things that are manifest in the Grassmannian picture. And there's 2 kinds, in fact, there's 2 sorts of relationships between these leading singularities that are manifest. One of them is that different leading singularities are actually algebraically equal. That's this sort of fact. The fact that these different looking pictures are actually algebraically equal is one set of relations that's made very manifest by this picture. Another set of relations are all the linear identities that are satisfied between them, which are a consequence of the global residue. All of the relationships between these objects are made manifest by thinking about them as residues in this Grassmannian field. Oh, well, okay. I'll come back after this little computation to tell you how to interpret the BCFW terms as leading singularities. I apologize. That's something I meant to say before getting into the computation. But I'll tell you. All right. So let's first figure out what the Z star is here. Here it's particularly easy to think about because 6 is being deformed in such a way that's going to put this thing on shell, right? So for p5 plus p6 squared to go on shell, that means angle bracket 5/6 times square bracket 5/6 should equal 0. I'm only deforming lambda 6, so that means that the angle bracket 5/6 is the thing that's being set to 0. So I can figure out what the z star is by putting 5/6 of z star equal to 0. So that tells me that 5/6 plus z star 1/6 is equal to 0. So that tells me what the value of z star is. All right, at that value of z star, I know that I have a nice 3-particle amplitude here. Okay? And in this 3-particle amplitude, so let me label the lambdas of this internal particle. Let me label it. Lambda internal, actually for fun, I'll put a negative sign in front of its lambda part, and lambda tilde internal. I put a minus sign there because then on this side, its momentum is opposite, so I can call it plus lambda I, lambda tilde I on this side. So the next task is to figure out what the lambdas and the lambda tildes of the internal particle are at z star, right? When I've tuned it to lie on that channel. All right. Well, actually, I shouldn't uniquely talk about lambda. I can always rescale lambda and lambda tilde. So, for convenience, I use the fact that this is a 3-particle amplitude, and I know for the 3-particle amplitude that I can make all the lambdas proportional to each other, or all the lambda tildes proportional to each other. It's one or the other. Okay. But I have just deformed. Let me put the minus sign there. I've just deformed the lambda 6. So what I should choose this lambda I to be equal to lambda 5. Okay. So basically I deformed lambda 6 so that lambda 6 becomes proportional to lambda 5, which becomes proportional to lambda I. All the lambdas are proportional to each other. And it's the lambda tildes that are going to be generic. Okay? Lambda tilde 6 I haven't touched. So lambda tilde 6, lambda tilde 5 are not proportional to each other. So what I've done is deform z to make all the lambdas proportional to each other. And in particular, I can choose lambda I to just be lambda 5. Okay? So let me choose that to be lambda 5. So lambda I is going to be lambda 5. Now let me work out what lambda tilde I is. Oops,
So, well, that's just momentum conservation. So I'll write it as negative lambda I, which is lambda phi, and lambda tilde I, plus lambda phi, lambda tilde phi, plus lambda hat 6 at z star, lambda tilde 6 equals 0. So I want to determine lambda tilde I. So let me determine lambda tilde I just by dotting this equation into lambda 6. I'm going to dot this equation into lambda 6. Then I get from here negative 5, 6 lambda tilde I, or 5, 6 lambda tilde I, bring it to the other side. Then from here 5, 6 lambda tilde 5 plus, I have to dot this into lambda 6. That piece cancels, so I just get z star times 1, 6. And z star times 1, 6 is just equal to negative 5, 6. Oh, sorry, times lambda tilde 6. So this is equal to 5, 6 lambda tilde 5 minus 5, 6 lambda tilde 6. So then I finally get a formula for lambda tilde I, which is lambda tilde 5 plus lambda tilde 6, I can write like this, 1 6, oops, sorry.
Minus lambda tilde 6.
Sorry, something just went wrong.
There's a negative sign in.
Yeah. But
the previous step.
Oh, I'm sorry. So, this is wrong. Right. So now, sorry. This is.
That's correct.
This is. No, sorry. I think it's. Let's just back up a second. So I'm dotting this into lambda 6 and z star. Sorry. Up here, you mean?
Yeah.
Here?
5, 6,
plus. Oh, that's a problem. Thank you. That's right. Plus 5, 1. That was. Thanks a lot. Okay, now that makes sense. So we get plus z star, and z star is negative 5, 6 over 5, 1. That's what I wanted. 1, 6. Lambda tilde 6. Okay. So I can divide by 5, 6, and I get that lambda tilde I is lambda tilde 5 plus 6, 1, lambda tilde 6 over 5, 1, which I can write it in an extra way as follows. P5 plus P6 times 1 divided by 5, 1. So let's go back to this picture. Just go back to this picture. You see, what's happened is that the deformation has caused, effectively, this internal particle to look just like 5 would have been. Its lambda and lambda tilde is almost the same as 5. In fact, its lambda is the same as a lambda of 5, but its lambda tilde has been deformed. Its lambda tilde has been acted on by adding 6. Okay. So it's like I have this 5 particle object, I'm adding particle 6 between particles 5 and 1 in this 5 particle object, and in doing that, I've deformed the 5 momentum away from what it was before to this new value. Okay. Effectively, this looks just like 5, but with its lambda tilde deformed. Similarly, up here, with that value of z star, we can see that lambda tilde 1 becomes p1 plus P6, 5 over 1, 5. So it's exactly the same form. It's precisely the same form. It's, again, it's like there was particle 5 and 1 sitting there. It's like particle 6 is being added between them. Particle 6 is being added between them, and it's changing the lambda tildes of the two adjacent particles. It changed the lambda tilde of 5, and it changed the lambda tilde of 1. You see that as P6 goes to 0, if we remove P6, there's no deformation. But when P6 is not equal to 0, we deform the lambda tildes while we keep the lambdas of 5 and of 1 unchanged. Okay. So this isn't true for every BCFW term. It's only true for this special kind of term, for the three-particle amplitude on one side. Oh, I should have also mentioned something. Notice that the helicity of this particle had better be, the helicity of this particle here had better be plus, because I've made sure now that all the lambdas are proportional to each other. So for this amplitude to be non-vanishing, it must involve only the lambda, it must involve the lambda tilde, so it's a plus plus minus amplitude. So that means on the other side, the helicity is minus as well. So once again, it looks just like it would have been 5, the helicity is the same. It's easy to see if this was plus, the argument would have been exactly the same, that would have had to be minus. So the helicity even on this side is the same. All that's happened on this side is I have what would have been the underlying five-particle amplitude. So it's really like a picture where I had particle 5 and 1. Okay? And it's like I'm adding particle 6 between 5 and 1. And what I've done is deform, I've deformed lambda tilde 5 prime is equal to P5 plus P6, 1 over 5, 1, and the other way around. Lambda tilde 1 prime is P6 plus P1, 5 over 1, 5. Okay. So now we know everything that's going to occur on this side. Now it's just a matter of a little bit of trivial bookkeeping. Well, let me just tell you, well, from what I've written down, it's now actually very easy to see what the general result is. The general result, whenever you have any such thing, whenever you have anything with a plus, let's say particle n plus here, n minus 1, this, and then with 1, 2, up to anything on this side, and minus 2 on this side, the general result that you get is a factor that's n minus 1, 1 over n minus 1, n, and 1 multiplied by this object, n right, but evaluated at where you now imagine that that's like n minus 1, where lambda tilde n minus 1 prime is equal to just what we said, Pn plus Pn minus 1, 1 over n minus 1, 1, and lambda tilde 1 prime is Pn plus P1 n minus 1 over 1 n minus 1. Over 1 n minus 1. And then everything else is the same. So this is a particularly simple kind of term in the BCFW formula. In fact, it perfectly has the property that in the limit, as you take the momentum of this particle to be zero, it looks like this simple universal factor times the lower amplitude now with no deformation anymore. And this factor is just the famous soft factor that happens for gluons in the soft limit. It's the only thing that you can have which bears some memory of the little group properties of this particle. Okay? You need that. But otherwise, other than that memory of its little group properties, nothing depends on it anymore. You just have to want one more. Now, I went through that song and dance just so you see what one term looks like, but also so you can see where these funny non-local poles are coming from. Okay? Because let's say this was a five-particle amplitude, so we can actually just do it explicitly in this simple example. If I go back to this simple example, I have 6, 1, 2. So what I get is 5, 1 over 5, 6, 6, 1, multiplied by simply, now I need to have this 5 particle amplitude at the deformed location for here and there. That's hat, and this is now, if you like, the 5 hat that ended up here. So what is that amplitude? Well, it's 2, 4 to the 4th. Let's do some of the, it's just a 5 particle anti-MHV amplitude. So it's a 2, 4 to the 4th, and then there's a, then there's the simple guys, let's just write them down, 2, 3, 3, 4. But then I have, for example, I have 1, 2. So remember, lambda tilde 1 is now P1 plus P6, 5, over 1, 5. So 1, 2 is equal to that one of the terms that we had over there. It's equal to 5 times P6 plus P1, 2. That came from what used to be a nice local term. That came from what used to be 1, 2. It's 1 half 2. Okay. The deformation turns something that was local into something non-local. And there's a 1, 5 down there, so it goes up there. Then there's 4, 5. Similarly, 4, 5, 5 got adjusted. So we get the other term there. We get the other non-local term, 1, 6 plus 5, 4. There's another 1, 5. Then there's 5, 1. Okay. So 5, 1 is also easy. We don't actually have to dot these things into each other. If I multiply the upstairs by another 5, 1, so downstairs I have angle bracket 5, 1, square bracket 5, 1, which is just P1 plus P1 hat plus P5 hat squared. And P1 hat plus P5 hat is just just P1 plus P5 plus P6. Okay, so I just got, that's the addition of momentum 6. So there's one more P1 plus P6 plus P5 squared. And then I'm done. And this is exactly the first term in the formula that we wrote down. Okay, so that's a complete computation for one of the terms.
The last term is just a propagator?
The last term arose from 5 hat 1 hat.
Right? The propagator.
The propagator, so this is what you get in general for that for that object. What happens is when you take this 3 particle amplitude, the 3 particle amplitude is this multiplied by the inverse of the propagator, and it cancels the propagator. Okay, so what you end up getting, I just skipped that to write the final form. So this term in BCFW always looks like that, and this in turn is exactly what we wrote. Okay. So there's an explicit there's a simple explicit computation. All right. We call these things, by the way, these particular cases where you have a 3 particle amplitude on one side that looks like it's just a particle being added to the underlying object, deforming the adjacent people. This thing is not affecting M. It's just changing the number of positive helicity particles. So we call this the M or K preserving inverse soft factor. Okay? We call it an inverse soft factor because that's what it looks like. It's adding a particle, not subtracting a particle. And it's an inverse of the soft factor because if you take the soft limit of the particle that's been added, you get back the original amplitude. So this is an interesting algebraic operation that you can take a lower particle amplitude, add something to it, to turn it into a higher particle object. Not an amplitude, but some higher particle object. It's been described here directly in momentum space What we'll start seeing tomorrow is a much more natural and Yangian invariant way of talking about all of these things. But this is just a simple example of something of a whole class of objects that we're going to talk about at greater length later. All right. So, any questions about this? Now we're going to transition to interpreting and seeing all these objects as Grassmannian residues and understanding where these identities come from. Okay. Just thought, once somebody should see this computer. Somebody should see a calculation like this. So. Even any idiot can do it. Okay, so let's now switch gears to actually computing residues in this Grassmannian flow. And it's going to be easiest for us to do this using the just computationally, and really computationally for a low number of particles, but still, it's useful, especially pedagogically. And also, actually, not just pedagogically, but because especially in our discussion of loops, we're going to make very heavy use of the momentum twister space way of thinking. Actually, in Freddy's discussion, some of Freddy's discussion is going to be much more naturally phrased in the twister space formulation of the Grassmannian rule. My discussion is mostly going to be natural the momentum twister form, and anyway, also computationally, it's a little simpler and is closer to the momentum space way of thinking about things. Anyway, so let's talk about the momentum twister space. And let's talk about the simplest case, which would have n equals 3, 3 negative velocity equal 1s, that class of superamplitude, and therefore k equals 1. So we're talking about n to the k MHP amplitudes. And so in the momentum twister space version, we're dealing with contour integrals over g, k, n. So this is particularly simple. This is just g, 1, n. And the contour integral in this case is an integral bc1, bc2, up to dcn, 1 over volume gl1. And the 1 by 1 minors of this 1 by n matrix are just c1 and cn.
Well, I use capital D.
Oh, you use capital D? Okay. D capital D1 over D1 of D capital Dn. Then we have delta 4/4 B1 Z1 plus Dn Zn. There's carcasses of chalk down here. All right. So this is particularly simple because there's no funny determinants. We can just really go ahead and compute. Okay? Let's do the simplest possible case, which is the n equals 5 example. Of course, n equals 5 is just, this is the anti-MHV amplitude. This is secretly just the parity conjugate of the MHV amplitude. So we know this guy better be really simple. But we're running in the momentum twister form. Remember, we're factoring out the overall factor of the MHV superamplitude. And so we're going to be left over with something non-trivial. M equals 2, k equals 0, we just get 1. So m equals 3, n equals 5, we're going to get something interesting. But something interesting is such that if you went back to momentum space, you'd just recognize it simply as exactly the Park-Taylor amplitude with lambdas and lambda tildes switched, and the eta tilde representation, not this eta, but the original ANNA and tilde representations for a transform with respect to each other as well. Okay. So it should be a very simple looking thing, and indeed it is. So let's start off doing the easiest thing. How do we fix this overall GL1 rescaling? So let's say there's five particles. We fix the overall GL1 rescaling just by declaring that D1, D5 is equal to 1. Okay? Let's say D5 is equal to 1. So we just said D5 equals 1. And so what we really have is the integral dd1 over d1 over dd4 over d4 delta 4/4 of d1 z1 plus d4 z4 plus d5, which is 1, z5. Okay? Now, in fact, these four bosonic delta functions are enough to completely solve for d1 up to d4. The reason is that the bosonic part of this guy says that z5, which is some bosonic 4-vector, is a linear combination of five guys. Okay? The minus sign, linear combination d1, z1, plus d2, z2, linear combination of four guys, plus d4, z4. But I can expand any 4-vector in a linear combination of four, any other 4-vectors. Okay? So these momentum twisters are generic, and so I can just solve them. How do I determine these coefficients? Well, I can just take the left-hand side and dot it with an epsilon symbol into, for example, 2, 3, and 4. Okay, if I dot it into 2, 3, and 4, then I find that negative 5, 2, 3, 4 is equal to D1, 1, 2, 3, 4. So this 4 bracket just means dotting everything with an epsilon symbol. And then all the other ones are 0. Okay? I'm dotting into 2, 3, and 4. So they all contain one of the guys that I'm dotting into. So it vanishes in contraction with the epsilons. So, okay, so D1 is just equal to 2, 3, 4, 5 over 1, 2, 3, 4. And similarly, I can solve for all the other ones. D2 equals, etc. Okay? It's obvious what they are. It's just the 4 bracket of the guys that are not, the 4 guys that are not that one. Okay? So I can solve for all the D's.
Sorry. This was okay. The integral where the MH2 was 3 plus.
Yes, that's right. So we're talking about the object which is left, the thing which is the function of the momentum twister. Okay. Mistake using this for a second. All right. So let's work out what it is. So we have something that looks like 1, 2, 3, 4 to the fourth, because there's 4 of them downstairs. All of them are going to have 1, 2, 3, 4. And then I have 2, 3, 4, 5. This is just the product of all the D's downstairs. Okay. Then the next one would be 1, 3, 4, 5 missing 2. The next one would be 1, 2, 4, 5. Missing 3, the next one will be 1, 2, 3, 5, missing 4. Okay. And there is one more factor. When I do this integral, I'm using this delta 4, 4. When I do this expansion, I'm using the delta 4 to solve for all the d's, but there's a Jacobian I have to pay. Right? I'm expanding in a basis of 1, 2, 3, and 4, and the Jacobian from the delta 4 part of the delta function is a factor of 1 over 1, 2, 3, 4. Just 1 over the determinant of the basis that I'm expanding in, which is 1, 2, 3, and 4. Okay, so the Jacobian gives me a 1 over 1, 2, 3, 4. So that's nice. Now downstairs, everything looks very symmetrical. What I have left is a fermionic delta function involving 8 of 5. Okay. And let's say I have the coefficient d1 a to 1. But what's d1? d1 is 2, 3, 4, 5 over 1, 2, 3, 4. A to 1. And then I have plus all the cyclic friends of that guy. Oh, but then now that 1, 2, 3, 4 to the 4th is very nice because I can take it inside the delta function This is a delta 0 slash 4. It's a fermionic delta function. So I'm left with delta 0 slash 4, 1, 2, 3, 4, a to 5, plus cyclic over 1, over 1, 2, 3, 4, 2, 3, 4, 5, 3, 4, 5, 1, 4, 5, 1, 2, 5, 1, 2, 3. Now, if this looks a lot like the Park-Taylor amplitude, or reminiscent of it, it should. Because each one of these factors is actually proportional to, each one of these factors is proportional to the angle bracket 1, 2, the square bracket 3, 4, times x4 minus x2 squared. Okay? So in fact, these brackets are where, if you put back the MHV prefactor, and you transform to the other representation, ultimately, we need a formula with all angle brackets downstairs, and all those cyclic angle brackets downstairs are just coming from these cyclic four brackets in the momentum distribution. But that's a nice exercise that if you want to play with it to see how it works. But this is what the anti-MHV amplitude looks like, the byproduct anti-MHV amplitude looks like in momentum distribution.
Can you repeat this? 1, 2, 3, 4 is equal to what? 1, 2.
Yeah, so it's just in general, zj minus 1 zj, zk minus 1 zk is j minus 1 j, k minus 1 k, times xk minus xj squared. And this guy, xk minus xj squared, would be, in this case where they're adjacent, would be P2 plus P3 squared. P2 plus P3 squared has the angle brackets. That's where the, has the square brackets in it. So that's where ultimately all the square brackets and the anti-MHV amplitude. All right, now this is a very, this is a nice general, that's the byproduct. Now let's move on to the general n-particle amplitude with k equals 1 or n equals 3. So, or not amplitude, residues. Okay? So we have d, d1 up to d1, d, dn over dn, delta 4, 4, I'm just writing down the formula again. d1, z1 plus dn, zn. Okay? Now, as Freddie explained to you, in general, there are m times n minus m, there are k times n minus k integration variables that we k times n minus k minus 4 integration variables, or m minus 2 times n minus m minus 2 integration variables. That's taking the support of this bosonic delta function into account. Okay. So in the end of the day, this is for our purposes, it's an n minus 5 dimensional integral. Okay. We just saw for n equals 5 that there was no integral to do because the delta functions fully localize all the d's. Starting with n equals 6, there's a one dimensional integral, n equals 7, two dimensional integral, and so on. We have an n minus 5 dimensional integral to do. It's extremely easy to see what the residues are, right? The only possible residues in this formula are circling some number of the d's equal to 0. Okay. In fact, how many of the d's do I need to set equal to 0? I need to set n minus 5 of the d's equal to 0. If I set n minus 5 of the d's equal to 0, I have 5 d's left that have not been equal to 0. Those 5 d's that are left that are not set to equal 0 can all be determined completely in exactly the same way. It didn't matter in that formula that it was 1, 2, 3, and 4 were consecutive with each other. There could have been any 5 guys in there, A, B, C, D, E, and I would have gotten that formula with 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 replaced by A, B, C, D, E. Okay? So the general residue involves setting. So let's do a particular case. Let's do the case n equals 6.
n equals 6, I can set a single one of the d's to 0. Whichever one that I'm setting to 0, I will denote that residue by just by putting it in brackets and saying I'm putting, let's say, 3 to 0. Okay? I'll denote that residue by putting 3 between parentheses. So here I've set d3 to 0, just by doing this little contour integral there around d3 equals 0. And then what's the associated residue? The associated residue is exactly the same formula with, instead of 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 1, 2, 4, 5, 6, without 3. In fact, I can define, in general, a nice object.
Nim, I think it's a bit too fast. Yeah? Can you slow down a bit? And
sure, sure, sure. Okay, so let's do the case n equals 6. In okay. Let's say we have n equals 6. So d up to d6 over d6. Okay? So the claim is that to do this integral, I have to think of it as a contour integral, and I need to set one of these minors, in this case the minors are just these 1 by 1 minors, one of the d's to 0. I could do it in the other order. If you like, I could first solve on the support of all these delta functions and be left explicitly with a function of n minus 5 variables. And then, in that remaining function of n minus 5 variables, I can choose various poles and compute residues. I'm just, for convenience, doing it the other way around, just because it makes the answer very, very clear. A residue is determined, for this case, by putting one of the d's to 0. Okay, so let's say, as I said, let's say I put d3 equals 0. When I say I'm putting d3 equals 0, I mean I'm doing the contour integral d3 over d3 around the d3 equals 0. Okay? I do that, and I just get 1 from here. That just gives me 1. But now d3 is 0. Okay? Now d3 is 0, and I'm left with the integral dd1 over d1, dd2 over d2, dd4 over d4, 5, dd6 over d6, delta 4, 4, d1, z1, dot, dot.
And you set d6 to 6. You set to 1 using gl1.
Well, and now I haven't done anything with gl1 yet. Now I can, for example, set d6 to 1 using the gl1. Okay? I set d6 to 1 and I do the result thing. I just do the, and I'll do exactly the same thing.
So each of these six terms you'll get will map to those six terms you got.
Exactly. We'll see that in a moment. We'll see that in a moment. We haven't seen that yet, but I'm just coming to that. All right. So there are six residues that we could talk about in this case. But in general, I can define an object that depends on 5 momentum twisters. These things are sometimes, they're written in a different way in the literature. They're sometimes called R invariants. We prefer to write them as this nice 5 object made out of 5 momentum twisters, which is just this fermionic delta function, delta 0, 4, A to A, E, C, T, E, plus cyclic, over the 5 guys, A, B, C, D, B, C, D, E, dot, dot. E, A, E, C. So let's just talk about this object in general. Then we see that the residue 3, which is associated with D3 equals 0, remember, the residue 3, for example, is nothing other than 1, 2, 4, 5, 6. Residue 5 is 1, 2, 3, 4, 6. So, okay. For this 6 particle case. All right. Now, actually, let's keep going with the 6 particle case for a second. If we keep going with the 6 particle case, we can see that every one of these residues, it looks
essentially exactly the same as the fine particle amplitude, right? It's the same as the fine particle amplitude, just having relabeled some of the particles. For example, let's talk about a particular residue. Let's talk about residue 6, for instance. Okay, residue 6 is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Heck, that looks just exactly like the five particle amplitude. What's going on? That looks like it's exactly just the five particle MHV amplitude. I've just added label 6, but label 6 doesn't exist anywhere here. What's going on? In fact, this residue corresponds to exactly the BCFW term that we just computed. This residue corresponds precisely to the action of the inverse soft factor where we added particle 6. This inverse soft factor, where you don't change k, in momentum twister space has an incredibly simple implementation. If you want to add particle 6 in momentum twister space, all you do is you add the label z6. You don't change anything, you just add particle 6. Okay? How can that possibly do what we saw back in momentum space? The reason is that when you go from the momentum twisters back to determine the momenta, now the presence of the particle 6 is going to change the lambda tildes for the particles 5 and 1. Right? The formula for the lambda tildes involves the two adjacent momentum twisters. So when 6 wasn't there, I had a certain set of lambdas and lambda tildes that happily conserved momentum. I'm now just doing something in momentum twister space. Anything I do is guaranteed to conserve momentum and keep things on shell. That was the beauty of these variables. Okay? So if I just add particle 6, I haven't changed the lambdas of 5 and 1, because they are what they are. The lambda tildes of 5 and 1 are now different. That's exactly what that inverse soft factor does. Okay? And in fact, the mere addition of particle 6 changes the momenta of particle, changes the lambda tildes of 5 and 1 in precisely the way that we just saw. And furthermore, that inverse soft factor, furthermore, that overall soft factor in front is precisely what it takes just to change the 5 particle to the 6 particle overall MHV factor in front of everything. So this is exactly correct. Just that trivial modification, just this trivial modification, is precisely the action of the inverse soft factor on the BCFW term. So this residue is the guy that we computed so laboriously in momentum space. Okay?
It's the part of it, the second part of it.
Huh?
Part of it.
No, that's right. It's written in momentum twister space. So if we had done it all supersymmetrically and we had factored out the MHV superamplitude, then what would be left is this. So you see, just the great power of this way of thinking about things is that these things become just obvious. And from what I told you before, all of the other guys, all the other residues, are just cyclically related in this simple way. So in fact, the BCFW form of the tree amplitude turns out to be precisely 6 plus 4 plus 2. And the PBCFW piece of the amplitude, form of the amplitude, ends up being precisely the terms negative 5, negative 3, negative 1. So the equality BCF equals PBCF is, as advertised, just the statement that the sum of the 6 residues of this one-dimensional contour in the grower equals 0. Complex analysis, you learn that residue theorems are an awesome way of proving identities. This is an awesome way of proving a very non-trivial identity involving these rational functions. Okay, but that they're telling you something about this residue theorem in the Russ method. Okay. So let me end by just telling you what the generalization of this story is. or any number of particles for next MHD amplitudes. So perhaps I can say this slightly more abstractly. We see that the tree amplitude is associated with a special contour. The tree amplitude is associated with the contour that I just take the even guys or I just take the odd guys. Okay? Why is that the tree amplitude? Actually, in this particular case, in the particular case of a six-particle amplitude, it's easy to see that the only cyclically invariant combination, the things that we're talking about need to be cyclically invariant. Okay? The super amplitude is cyclically invariant. It's easy to see in this case, the only possible cyclically invariant combination is 1 minus 2 plus 3 minus 4 plus 5 minus 6. Very naively, you might have thought it to be 1 plus 2 plus 3 plus 4 plus 5 plus 6, but that would have been 0. Okay? That's 0 by the residue theorem. And in fact, I don't have time to talk about it. When you think a little more carefully about how the cyclic action acts, cycling over by 1 should give you a minus sign. So what you need is something which picks up for an even number of particles, a minus sign when you cyclically shift it, for an odd number of particles, a plus sign. So for an even number of particles, it needed to pick up a minus sign. And in fact, the unique cyclically invariant contour that you can build with six particles is 1 minus 2 plus 3 minus 4 plus 5 minus 6. That's the object that's manifestly cyclically invariant. You can then notice that by a residue theorem, you can rewrite it as 1 plus 3 plus 5, or as 2, negative 2, negative 4, negative 6. So one thing which is being made morally obvious by the whole Grassmannian picture is that amplitudes don't want to be conequipped in some specific form. It's a contour integral. And there's lots of different representatives you can choose for a given homology class. If you want to think about, if you want to think even for one-dimensional contour, there's a bunch of poles. You take the poles out of the complex plane, and then there are curves that you can or can't continuously shrink to zero, and different curves that can be connected to each other are characterized some homology class. So a contour is just specifying some homology class of contours in this space. Similarly for higher dimensional integrals. Okay? So there's many different representatives that you can choose, and they're related to each other by contour deformation. That makes something morally obvious that the amplitude or the objects don't want to be presented in any particularly unique form. That's something, one of the striking features of BCFW. Which is very unlike a Lagrangian. It just gives you an answer. You compute Feynman diagram, you get an answer. Okay? Here you can get in this form, you get in that form, and now that has a moral understanding. It's because it's coming from a contour. Something is special about the contour. Okay? So we still haven't exposed what it is. In this particular six-particle case, it was nailed for us by cyclicity. Okay? And then it was interesting that it could be written in this purely even or purely odd fashion. In this case, it was nailed. Now let me tell you what the contour ends up being for any NMHD amplitude, for any N. The answer ends up being the following. Here's what it is for seven particles. It's 1, 2. So for seven particles, I have to put two, in general, N minus 5 guys to 0. So I have to give you a list of N minus 5 Bs that are being set to 0. Okay? So it's 1, 2, plus 1, 4, plus 1, 6. Plus 3, 4, plus 3, 6, plus 5, 6. That's one form. Well, there's another form, which is 2, 3. So it's even odd. Plus 2, 5, plus 2, 7, plus 4, 5, plus 4, 7, plus 6, 7. These two things are equal to each other by a residue theorem. Perhaps I'll explain that in just a moment. It doesn't take a lot of time. But so just to finish characterizing what the contour is, for eight particles, it'll be 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 5, 1, 2, 7, 1, 4, 5, 1, 4, 7. In general, it's even, odd, even, odd, even, odd, writing every way of writing even, odd, even, odd, even, odd, in strictly increasing order. Okay. These are Yang-Mills-theory amplitudes, I remind you. They're incredibly combinatorial objects.
This is the general. You write even odd.
Even odd, even odd. This is for NMHK amplitudes, and it's just even odd, even odd, even odd. So it's even odd, the sum over all increasing sets of integers, in the brackets, even odd, even odd, even odd, n minus 5 factors.
I was surprised how could it be
bad. So it's just even odd, even odd, even odd. Or you can write as odd, even, odd, even, odd, even, n minus 5 factors. And these two things are equal to each other up to a minus 7.
You're using much fewer residues than there are.
Absolutely. Absolutely. This is because, well, this is what you're saying is very near and dear to our heart. Because when we first ran into this contour integral, we were just thrilled that it was computing BCFW terms in the tree amplitude. But we had this little puzzle that there were many, many, many more residues than there were things that we were using, which is how we started realizing that there were higher loop objects in it as well. And eventually realized that it contained all leading singularities to all loop work. So we're using a tiny subset of all the residues at the moment. But anyway, there they are. Let me give you a little bit of a little bit of a flavor of how you can see that there is a residue theorem relating these things to each other. Just because I think Freddie might need this, and this will just take me 5 minutes, and I think I can end quickly. Okay. In general, let's talk about the seven-particle amplitude, okay? The seven-particle amplitude, we have an integral which is, in the end of the day, an integral over two parameters. If I now imagine using the bosonic delta functions first, I have an integral over two parameters left. So it doesn't, I don't need to be very specific about it. I can call it d tau 1 over d tau 2, but I have seven denominator factors, d1 up to d7, that depend on these two variables, tau 1 and tau 2. Now we compute residues the way we talked about computing residues before. Okay, we compute residues using the formulas I told you last time.
So you use the GL1 and you did the opposite order. First, it fits the
order. That's right. Exactly. That's right. So that there is a exactly. All right. Now. So there are 7 choose 2 residues that I could talk about. There's 21 residues that I could talk about. I need to set 2 denominator factors to 0 to solve for tau 1 and tau 2. So there's 7 choose 2 equals 21 residues that I could talk about. Now, I told you that when you have more than one variable, there are residue theorems. And the residue theorems tell you to group the denominator into the product, if there are two variables here, into the product of 2 polynomials, right? And then you sum over all the roots of those 2 polynomials, setting both of them to 0, and the sum of all of those residues is equal to 0. Okay? That's the global residue theorem. So here, any way of splitting up these guys into 2 sets gives me a residue theorem. For example, I can split it up where one set is d1, d2, the other set is d3, d4, d5, d6, d7. So this could be p1. This could be P2. And the global residue theorem will tell you that the sum of all the residues associated with putting P1 to 0 and P2 to 0 is 0. So what are those residues? They're the ones where I can set P1 to 0 by setting D1 to 0, for example, and P2 to 0 by setting D3 to 0. So that's one of the roots of P1 and P2 equals 0. So that's 1-3. But there's also 1-4. 1-5, 1-6, 1-7, and 2 plus 2-3, 2-4, 2-5, 2-6, 2-7. Okay? So this denotes the residues, and the global residue theorem tells you that the sum of all these things is equal to 0. And you can see you could get many different residue theorems depending on how you grouped up the denominator into P1 and P2. There's a particularly canonical way of grouping them into P1 and P2, which is to just choose one of them to be P1 and the rest of them to be P2. Okay? Let's say you choose one of them to be P1 and the rest of them to be P2. Then let's say I choose P1 to be 1. Then a resolute theorem is 1, 2 plus 1, 3 plus 1, 4 plus 1, 7 equals 0. In general, it would be J, the sum over I of JI is equal to 0. In this sum, I don't need to stipulate that I is not equal to J. If you remember, these residues are naturally antisymmetric alternating objects, so they vanish when J equals I. Okay? So all residue theorems for the seven particle case are that for some choice of J. Okay? For all J, well, for any J, actually, for any J, this is a residue. Now, let me prove to you that that identity is true. That 12-term identity is a consequence of the global residue theorem. To do that, I just have to write down these set of global residue theorems, three of these global residue theorems. Let's write them down. Let's write them down when the J's here are, say, even. Okay? So I'm going to write down the global residue theorem 2, 1 plus 2, 3 plus 2, 4 plus 2, 5 plus 2, 6 plus 2, 7 equals 0. That's one global residue theorem. Another one is 4, 1 plus 4, 2 plus 4, 3 plus 4, 5 plus 4, 6, plus 4, 7 equals 0. And the final one is 6, 1, plus 6, 2, plus 6, 3, okay? These are three different global residue theorems. Now let's add them up. Now, a little bit of magic happens right away. For instance, notice that there's this term, just 2, 4, right? Even, even. There's a 2, 4 there, but there's a 4, 2 there. Remember, these residues are antisymmetric objects. So 2, 4 is equal to negative 4, 2. So when I add them up, these cancel. Okay. 2, 6 cancels against 6, 2. All the even evens cancel, okay? 4, 6 cancels against 6, 4. 2, 1, I can write as negative 1, 2. Let me put a negative in front of it. Negative 1, 2. I got rid of it. I took care of it.
You had those three lines or also the first one?
Huh? Sorry? No. I'm just looking at these three lines. I'm just adding up these three lines. Okay. I have 1, 2. 1, 4. 4, 1 is negative 1, 4. One, six. Then I have 3, 4. 3, 6. 5, 6. Which again, I always convert. So I have 3, 4 plus 3, 6 plus 5, 6. I have negative all of those plus the remaining ones, 2, 3, 2, 5, 2, 7, 4, 5, 4, 7, 6, 7. Guys, on the other side. Plus 2, 3, 2, 5, 2, 7, plus 4, 5, plus 4, 7. 6, 7 equals 0, which is nothing other than that statement, PCF composed PCF. Okay. So these contours are not manifestly cyclically invariant, but they are cyclically invariant. They're cyclically invariant as a consequence of contour decoupling. This argument generalizes. The most general global residue theorem in this simple in these simple examples is always in this form. You pick a J, and then you pick n minus 6 guys here, okay? And then you just add up the global residue theorem where these n minus 6 guys are odd, even, odd, even, odd, even. For all possible combinations of increasing odd, even, odd, even, odd, even, you add up all those global residue theorems, and it always turns into the statement that the contour that we just defined gives you a cyclically invariant result. So this proves in one shot the 12-term, 20-term, bajillion-term identities that tell you that the amplitude is cyclically invariant, and also tell you that it's free, indirectly tell you that it's free of spurious poles, okay? That it's a local object. So there's this very combinatorial thing sitting there, odd, even, odd, even, odd, even, and contour deformation is telling you that this is something which wants to be cyclic and wants and has a local interpretation. Now, I just told you that these are the BCFW terms. We just saw it. We just recognized it. We saw a pattern. Okay? I haven't told you why you would consider this object to begin with, other than the fact that it looks kind of cool, and it's sort of interesting that it manages to be cyclic in this non-trivial way. But other than that, I haven't told you why you would want to consider this contour. Okay? That's what Freddy's going to explain to you tomorrow. He's going to explain to you more invariantly, or he's going to start telling you more invariantly what's special about this contour. Okay? There is a question you can ask, a natural Grassmannian question that you can ask, that forces you to choose this contour. And that's the sort of final, that's the final completely second formulation for what the amplitudes are. Okay? A question on its own turf whose answer ends up being the local amplitude. He's also going to explain in some of his lectures, I hope, we'll see. No, but this much he'll definitely explain. He's also going to explain how you can take these contours and do another kind of contour deformation on them to go from this PCFW presentation of the tree amplitudes to the earlier CSW representation of the tree amplitudes. And that formulation much more directly makes the space-time Lagrangian manifest. Looks like it's coming from Feynman diagrams and Lightcone gauge. So it's a much closer connection to seeing the local space-time physics emerge. But really, the most interesting thing he's going to tell you about is why this contour arises to begin with. Why you would want to sum over this class of residues if you hadn't heard of BCFW field theory and all the rest of it. So the final very quick comment to make is that it turns out here I've only told you about some of the information contained in these global residue theorems, which tells you about the quality of these different BCFW forms of the amplitude. It turns out that every single one of these global residue theorems has some physical significance. I didn't have a chance to explain it today, but the BCFW terms are particular classes of leading singularities, of certain one-loop diagrams. So, and the way BCNF before W got to the recursion relations was enforcing the infrared consistency of one-loop amplitudes. You look at one-loop amplitudes, another classic feature of locality in standard field theory is that the double logarithmic divergences of one-loop amplitudes must be proportional to tree amplitudes. Okay. If you just take that statement, compute the one-loop amplitudes using the leading singularity methods, and just force that equation, the double logarithmic divergences of the tree amplitude should be proportional, of the loop amplitude should be proportional to the tree amplitude, you get a whole ton of equations, many, many equations. Many equations that have to be satisfied by the leading singularities. Okay. These equations encode unitarity, they encode all sorts of things in general, but in particular, they encode this infrared consistency of the one-loop amplitudes. Infrared consistency tells you linear relations that have to be satisfied between these objects. Freddy and his friends found one linear combination of these equations that turned into the BCF recursion relations, the BCFW recursion relations. There are other linear combinations that are other interesting constraints that have to be satisfied by the leading singularities. But they all turn into linear relationships between leading singularities. Bunch of sums of leading singularities with various coefficients have to equal zero. Quite amusingly, the way they come out of field theory, various coefficients of halves and twos and minus ones, and they're sort of haphazardly distributed. But when you carefully take the relationship between those coefficients and the residues, you find that they beautifully all turn into just these global residue curves. Okay. So infrared consistency. Further things. The dual conformal invariance of suitably infrared regulated quantities, and so on. Lots and lots of conditions all follow, are all equivalent to these relationships between the residues. None of them are wasted. They all have some physical role to play. And again, this is all pushing in the direction. It's motivational until actually Freddy shows you tomorrow. I mean, after you see it, it's not motivational anymore. You see an example. But before you find the example, these things are motivating that there is a completely second way of formulating things, because all these physically important things have a totally different explanation in this picture. We don't have to go all the way back to field theory to come up with a very indirect proof for why there are these linear relationships between algebraic objects. They have a very direct interpretation directly in the Gauss-Einstein. All right, thank you for your patience, and we'll pick up again tomorrow.